Okay, the Environment, Economic Development, Agriculture Division for April 23rd, 2013 will come to order. We don't have a quorum yet, Senator Sebring, but so we can't move your amendment yet, but you can go ahead and describe what you've got here, and you can give us a little history of the bill, maybe. So, Senator Sebring, Senate File 382.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Senate File 382 is a consumer protection bill, and what it does is attempts to stop the sale of fraudulent coin dealers. Members may have heard this bill in another committee or heard me discuss it, but the Star Tribune did a series of articles over the past months and years, a couple years actually, about fraudulent coin dealers here in Minnesota who have been especially targeting senior citizens. So what has happened is these bad actors have solicited, usually by phone, but sometimes then in follow-up in person, usually senior citizens who have, they have promised delivery of coins that sometimes the coins were never delivered. And so the Attorney General and her office have worked on this legislation, developing the legislation. The bill has proceeded through a number of committees, at which time we've attempted to work, and we have been working with the coin dealers and other interested parties in the state to try to get this bill right, so we're indeed targeting the bad actors and setting up a system, a regulatory process here in Minnesota through the Department of Commerce that will register those good actors, I should say, or the businesses in Minnesota that are honorably doing business. And so the bill that's before us now has had several amendments, and there is another amendment that is a result of this continuing discussion we've had with some of the different groups. So the A-10 amendment, which I don't know if members have in your packets or
not. We do.
You do. Mr. Frichte from the Attorney General's office can explain it in more detail, but it references a coin value, which was changed to investment value. It deletes a section defining consumer fraud as it relates to bullion coins, and it includes a more detailed description of the Commerce Commissioner's authority. So perhaps Mr. Frichte could expand on the A-10 amendment. But the bill overall is supported, and I think you have letters in your packet from the AARP and the Better Business Bureau, who both testified in previous committees, their support for the bill.
Mr. Frichte, why don't you explain the amendment while we're waiting for a quorum so we can act on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The amendment is to get all the moving pieces in one spot. What it does is clarifies Commerce's enforcement authority. Its language that is very similar to what's in Chapter 80A, having to do with securities, and it clarifies what steps Commerce will take. It also, even said, it is supported by both AARP and the Better Business Bureau, and our office in the Commerce Department and Senator Sebring have been working with industry, and that's what some of these changes reflect, some of the changes in the language to those that were heard in previous committees. You'll see that there's a tiered surety bond in there. There was also the removal of a section General's Office authority in Chapter 8.31 because we felt it was duplicative to what was already in statute. And just getting to what the problem is that this is trying to address, our office has received well over 100 complaints from consumers who have lost money, in some cases hundreds of thousands of dollars, when they have either sent coins to a coin dealer to be sold or sent, in a couple of cases, over $100,000 to a coin dealer to purchase coins, and the coins simply aren't delivered or the money is kept. What this bill does then is create a registration system. You'll see in the legislation the cost of registering for the coin dealer and the coin dealer representatives. It sets up a screening process. As this bill has gone through committees, the Commerce Department has the authority in many cases to accept or deny a registration, but for several felony-level offenses, it is a bar to acting as to owning one of these businesses or selling or purchasing coins to consumers. What this bill does not deal with, this bill does not deal with IRAs, sales of bullion, securities firms, auctions, things like that. This is only collectible coins. That's it. So I would stand for any questions that the members may have.
Are there any questions, Mr. Senator Weber?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question. I mean, in those situations where the unfortunate circumstances have occurred, Mr. Fritchie, what options do the coin owners, people that have been swindled, what options do they have right now?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, right now they can sue, and many people have sued. Unfortunately, many of the coin dealers that have engaged in this, they're simply gone. They have no assets. Several are facing criminal prosecution. There is one case that we have sued that is currently being litigated in bankruptcy court. So there is no recourse for people like that. This law builds in a surety bond requirement, and the surety bond isn't there for people who have a dispute over the value. It's if someone has taken their coins or taken their funds. So it also allows people to check, hey, is this a reputable business who has been registered by the state?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Stephen.
If members look on page 5 of the fiscal note, which I assume they have in their packet, you'll see that the initial license fee for the dealers is $25, and then $10 fee for their representatives or the people that work for them. And then the renewal is a little bit less. So you'll see that with the establishment of the new authority that the Department of Commerce will have, the fiscal note, it ends up, there's a slight savings to the state just by rounding, but the bill is in general no cost to the state because of the fees that are established in the bill, in the legislation.
So these kind of bills always are curious to me that we don't have statutes that already cover these kinds of criminal activities. Is that why we're doing this, or is this just adding more teeth to the statute?
Mr. Chair, I think it would be termed as adding more teeth to the statute and adding some more protection requiring these. One of the problems that our office has seen is many of the people that are engaged in these sales have extensive criminal backgrounds. This isn't the first time they've cheated people. This is set up so that those folks would not be able to engage in this kind of business. There's also a large the surety bond also is what it's similar to what there are in other regulatory schemes that the Department of Commerce oversees. It provides some sort of financial protection.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is somewhat related. I think we're still on the amendment, aren't we?
Yes.
Page 4.
We haven't acted on it yet because we don't have a quorum.
Okay.
So.
Yeah.
We have a quorum. Okay. A quorum is present. Okay. Go ahead.
Just a question. Page 4, and with regards to the commissioner's action against coin dealers, you have two sentences there that address two different types of sanctions. Can you tell me what kind of sanctions these could be or would be or have been in the past, or again, kind of off of the chairman's question, what kind of teeth are we giving?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, can you direct me to the
page 4, 4.26, subdivision 2 there.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I believe that refers to the section 10 of the bill on page 8. It talks about the civil action that can be instituted by the commissioner. Gives the Commerce Department the authority to take the take similar actions that they do in other businesses. It's, they can institute a civil action in district court, but they can also issue a cease and desist order, revoke, suspend, revoke the registration, those kind of things. And those are things that they are not allowed to do right now. The only thing that the only enforcement authority we have is the Attorney General's office or a private individual can sue someone who has swindled them.
So the follow-up, Mr. Chair, thank you. So there's no action that can be taken criminally then?
There are criminal actions that can be taken, and I am aware that law enforcement is looking at some of these folks right now. This is designed to help folks, primarily senior citizens, not lose so much money. The criminal laws are still there. The criminal laws have teeth, but the criminal laws don't seem to be stopping these folks.
Senator Ingebretson. Thank you, and I really appreciate that because I, in the world I come from, seniors were victimized, and we organized law enforcement statewide to address that, and they really truly are, and they're the one of the last people to admit that they're being victimized, and for reasons, for whatever. But the other question I would have is. I hope I'm working off the same document here.
The A-10.
Yes, the A-10, page 4.1, right at the top there, 4.1 and 4.2, giving the commissioner, based on the cost of processing registrations, may be adjusted. Can you tell me how that would work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebretson, in my conversations with the Commerce Department, I don't want to speak for them, but what they've told me is their idea is they may be able to adjust it down, adjust the fee down.
Mr. Chairman, Peter Brickwood, Director of Government Affairs for the Department of Commerce, Senator Ingebretson. That is correct. Our fiscal note, the fee that is currently in the bill covers the department's costs fully, and as has been mentioned at the moment, has a small savings to this, a small amount of revenue to the state, and that was simply our effort to charge a round dollar fee as opposed to $25 in some sense, if you will. But our expectation would be that we would adjust the fee downward if we were that proved to be an overcollection of sorts. That said, additionally, if it could go the other way, if there was a tremendous number of people that we were unaware of suddenly entering this business, we could adjust the fee upwards as well. But our expectation would be that the level that it is set at the bill in the bill now would cover our costs, and if anything, it would be adjusted downward.
Senator Osmek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All the talk about good actors and bad actors, I'm wondering if we're back to snow bait again. But to the testifiers.
You'd be one of the good actors.
Okay. To the testifiers and Senator Sieben, in this bill, it does a lot of protecting of the public from disreputable dealers, the bad actors. I'm wondering where in this bill could you point or direct me to that actually would provide some level of protection for the dealers themselves from a ingenious, devious consumer from using this as a weapon for perhaps a bad investment that they may have made. They may have made a bad choice. That this could be actually used as a weapon against dealers. Can you point to me some of the highlights here that could maybe also protect those dealers from having this used as a weapon against them?
Mr. Frickley.
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmek, The area I can take it to has to do with the surety bond. The surety bond is not available for someone who has a dispute. You can't go after the surety bond. A consumer can't, nor could the Attorney General or the Commerce Department go after the surety bond in just a bad investment case. That is only available if there's non-delivery of coins or non-delivery of money, a straight-out theft. Everything else, it would have to be proven. If someone has violated this law, it's going to have to be either proven in district court or in the Office of Administrative Hearings.
Okay. Senator Weber, do you have a no? Is there anybody who wants to testify for or against this amendment? We have someone back here. Mr. Appetz.
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Appetz. Excuse me, law firm of Messerly and Kramer, and I'm here representing the Consumer Data Information Industry Association. I'll be very brief, and it's not a criticism of the bill whatsoever. I just want to note one slight item that is on page six, it's lines 8 and 9. There's a screening process that bullion dealers will have to go through to achieve a license to be able to participate in the industry. And on pages 6, 8, 9. I'm sorry, I got the wrong one. Okay. I apologize, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
We fix it.
Senator, it's on page 5, lines 27 and 28. I apologize. There's reference to a specific organization that would do the sort of screening that's called for in this initial screening in here. And I represent an organization which is essentially a competing organization, another group of screening providers. And our concern is that if you identify one sort of organization of screening providers here, they are given some special attention, some additional sort of, preference. And what we would prefer is that you just have a sort of a generic definition of this. I've provided some language to the Department of Commerce and to the Attorney General's office. I know they're looking at it right now. They've been very busy the last couple of days and haven't had a chance to approve this. But I think we've got a fairly reasonable, resolution of this, and hopefully we can get it done in the next committee. I just want to make a quick reference to that, and hopefully you'll understand the reasoning that we've got here, so you don't provide a preference in the law for one organization over another. That's all. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and committee members, with regards to that, I don't think we're not necessarily opposed to what Mr. Apitz is proposing, except at this time we just need to look at the language more closely since we just recently got it today. I'd note that in the language of the bill on 5.28, it does say or an equivalent vendor to conduct the background screening process. And so I guess I'm not saying we're opposed. We just haven't had time yet to fully see what he's proposing.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Real quickly, Mr. Chair, how many background screeners are there for this, Mr. Apitz? Can you give us an idea?
Two.
Pardon me. Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think there's multiple companies. I don't know, there's at least two organizations that represent multiple companies that do employment screening, do credit checks, do a variety of different sorts of background investigations. And the concern that the Attorney General's office raised, and it is a good one, is that they be at a level of professionalism that is appropriate for what they're trying to accomplish here, that you have credible, reputable people involved in this sort of practice. Those are the types of folks who are members of the Consumer Data Industry Association. We believe similarly with the other organization as well. We're not criticizing them. We're just saying when you put somebody's name in the statute, it has a significance all its own. So there are multiple vendors, Mr. Chairman.
Point well taken. And you're going to work through this with Mr. Apitz, I take it. Is that right? We're not ready today to fix it, though. Okay.
Appreciate your consideration.
All right. Is there anybody else who wants to say anything about the A-10 amendment? And if nobody is coming forward, then Senator Herr will move the A-10 amendment. Any further discussion by the committee? Senator Westrom?
Mr. Chair, real briefly, too. I can see Mr. Apitz's point. So I would be hopeful that they work out neutral language. Just a direct mention can imply a preference in statute. I don't think that's our intent here.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the 810 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Mr. Mueller, you have another amendment here that has here. That is the 812 amendment. Stephen, I'll let Mr. Mueller explain it. I think you know what this is, though, right? A-12 amendment?
Correct.
Mr. Mueller?
Mr. Chairman, what this amendment does is the fee that's collected in the bill, right now the way it's written, would just go into the general fund, and then the bill would need a separate appropriation to get the money back out. What the amendment is doing is appropriates the fee. It puts the fee into a special revenue account, or a special account in the special revenue fund, and then appropriates it back to the department to implement this act. So it just spends the money that they collect for the fee, and that's it.
Any discussion, members?
Mr. Chair, just one quick question. I think it says enforce this section. Shouldn't that be this chapter?
Is it a whole chapter?
It is, Mr. Chair, Mr. Mueller. There are a number of other sections, and I think that they would need to be broader than that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Change. Mr. Chairman, members, on line 1.8, delete section and insert chapter.
Okay, so we'll incorporate that into the amendment. Okay, so Senator Herr moves the 812 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion is adopted. Mr. Mueller, do we need to discuss the fiscal note at all?
Mr. Chairman, not really. The fiscal note is actually to the second engrossment of the bill, but mostly the part of the fiscal note that we would probably look at. Senator Sieben already pointed out the on page 5 of the fiscal note, it shows how much they're going to collect in fees. And the way now that the amendment, the 812 amendment that we just adopted, it would appropriate that fees back to the agency to cover their costs. So whatever they collect in fees, they're going to have to, will have to cover their costs. They're anticipating the cost to be pretty close to what the fees were going to collect anyways. So I don't think this amendment should be a problem.
So essentially there's no cost to the general fund then?
Exactly, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any other questions or comments from Senator Sieben? Senator Sieben, any final comments? All right, then Senator Herr moves that Senate File 382 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scalzi, Senate File 613.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill. This bill, Senate File 613, relates to the Public Facilities Authority, otherwise known as the PFA. They're a multi-agency financing authority that help finance infrastructure programs for mainly smaller communities that don't have enough resources to replace failing stormwater and wastewater systems. So it's through a series of local loans and grants. And here today is Jeff Freeman, the executive director of the PFA.
Mr. Freeman, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. You should have in your packets a handout with our little PFA logo on it that summarizes the bill. This bill makes some small changes to PFA programs. There's no funds appropriated with this bill. It just modifies some programs so they'll work a little better. Primarily focused on the programs that the PFA has that have been funded through the Clean Water Legacy Funds. The first sections, 1, 2, and 3 of the bill focus on what right now are two separate programs, the Total Maximum Daily Load TMDL grant program, then also the phosphorus reduction grant program. Both of these were created, I think, 2005 and 2006, both intended to help cities by providing 50% grants for the additional costs that cities incur when they have to provide an additional level of treatment. And they were created separately, but really there's a lot of overlap between these programs. We'd like to merge them into one program. It'll simplify administration. It'll simplify the application process for cities, bring into line the funding caps and things. And then the changes would go one step further to make any time a city is required to implement an additional level of wastewater treatment, meet some additional standards above and beyond what they would otherwise have to do, they could access these funds and wouldn't have to wait for a TMDL plan to go through the entire process of approval. So it would basically speed up these projects, allow cities to access these funds and get their projects built more quickly. Then next, the small community wastewater treatment program, and these changes are in sections 4, 5, and 6 of the bill. This is the program that's focused on very small, unsewered communities, typically 20 to 30 households or less, with straight pipe raw sewage discharges. There are some difficult problems to solve in a way that both fixes the problem and is affordable to the residents. There's a technical assistance grant component to this program. We would increase the cap on that TA grant and make counties eligible, which we think is one of the keys to getting good projects. It would also make some changes, increase the cap on the construction funding and bring the grant component of the construction funding in line with the affordability criteria of our other program, the WIF, or Wastewater Infrastructure Fund program, which applies for a little bit larger cities. So it would make those consistent grant criteria. And then finally, Section 7 of the bill addresses a situation with past recipients of those WIF funds. The WIF program was created in the mid-90s to help communities with high-priority wastewater treatment needs that couldn't afford to do a project just with our low-interest loan funds. And the WIF program was created to provide some supplemental assistance. It was a grant program from the mid-90s when it was created through 2005. And then at that point, it changed from grants to deferred loans as we were trying to work out some issues with the term of our loans versus the term of loans with other funders that we partner with. In 2011, it changed back again. We were able to deal with the loan term through some federal, an exception to the federal law for our loan program. Anyway, the upshot is that there were 16 communities that got grant or deferred loans in that window of time. Everybody before them and then again after, in a similar situation, got grant funds. What we'd like to do is take the current grant criteria, go back and apply it to those projects that were funded during that period of time, and to the extent then they're eligible, convert those deferred loans to grants. So it's a fairness thing to make them equal with everybody else that's gotten this assistance.
So what you're trying to do is make it easier to get to the money and actually award more money? Is that kind of what you're trying to do on the small grants program?
It would make it easier to access the funds. Yes, Mr. Chair, our funding request, actually, which you'll be hearing about with the legacy discussion next, we actually requested less funds for this program. We think we've got that'll provide sufficient funding for the projects that are eligible, but these changes will speed things up, will allow cities to move ahead with those projects more quickly.
And in the case of these WIF loans, I'm just looking at one that's in my district, the Elborn Township, the number of people that are on this system is really, really small. And are they expected to pay it all back, or does it eventually become forgivable, or how does it work?
Currently, Mr. Chair, these deferred loans were made as a package with our regular loan program, so they're already repaying the loans under our Clean Water Revolving Fund loan program. And then this loan, it was designed as deferred payment, so they pay back for the first 10 or usually 20 years through the revolving fund program, and then when they've got that loan repaid, then the repayments on this loan start and go for up to another 10 years. What's happening is, of course, these are hardship communities to begin with, and so they had to raise rates significantly to repay that first Clean Water Revolving Fund loan, and now they're looking ahead at when these other repayments are going to start kicking in, which would require some additional rate increases, and it will be a significant burden on some of these very small communities.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In those cases, Mr. Freeman, would there be situations where, as they projected their water rates,
so they won't have to repay them,
pay for their loans, that the payment of those deferred loans would already have been factored in, and would they? Is there a way that we monitor that to say, okay, you have now gotten those forgiven, but then that they're that the ratepayers get, the appropriate adjustment? Or would those be just continuations of current rates to pay those deferred loans?
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, it would be somewhat case by case, but in there may be situations where a community could back down the rates a little bit, or it may be a situation where they wouldn't have to increase them in the future, or maybe not as much as they would otherwise have to. We would always still, of course, want them to be generating sufficient revenue, not just to repay loans and cover O&M, but also cover some depreciation as well. So each one is going to be different, but it certainly would mean that they would not have to raise them as much as they otherwise would have to.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Then Senator Scalzi moves that Senate File 613 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you, Mr. Freeman.
Senator, Mr. Chair, then does this go to the whole Committee on Finance, to Senator Cohen's committee?
Correct, yes.
It doesn't go directly to the floor?
No, we can't do it from here. We have to go through via Finance.
Okay, thank you.
Could send you to bonding if you wanted to go to bonding.
Put yeah.
It might not be a bad place to go either. yeah. So who's got the clean water legacy discussion here? Members, what we're going to do here is just discuss this, you can ask any questions you want and try and figure out exactly what is going to be the recommendation for the clean water legacy. And then the subcommittee that Senator Cohen has set up of the finance committee is where the action will take place as far as actually making any changes or any recommendations to the full finance committee. So I'll let Mr. Mueller get started on. We have a spreadsheet in our packet. Is that what we have? There's a spreadsheet that looks like this.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'll just briefly go through what the spreadsheet covers. We've had two previous biennials where we've appropriated the clean water money, and what this spreadsheet does is shows the appropriations for the last two bienniums. You'll see the first column there. The last, and a lot of times in those bienniums, we appropriated most of the money in the first year, out of the first year of the biennium, and then we would come back the second year and make some changes. But so each of these biennium columns contain all the appropriations for the biennium. So we have fiscal year 10 and fiscal year 11, money going to the Department of Ag, PFA. These are pretty much the traditional agencies. I'm not going to go through each line item, but you can see where the money has been appropriated over the last two bienniums. And then the last column over to the right is what's either in the governor's recommendation or in Senate File 1051, which is a Senator Cohen bill that pretty much captures all the appropriations that were in the from the Clean Water Fund and the Parks and Trails Fund that were in the governor's budget. So it doesn't necessarily reflect what's in the Clean Water Council's recommendations. Their recommendations are pretty close to the governor's. On the last page, you'll see the total amount that's been appropriated. The first biennium that we had the Clean Water Fund, we appropriated $152.2 million. The biennium we're in right now, we appropriated $185.4 million. And then looking ahead, the governor recommended, again, about another $185 million. But if you look at line 198, and if you take an estimate of leaving 5% of the fund balance in the Clean Water Fund, you could have probably appropriated close to almost $191 million. And that's what the House is a little bit over at. They're a little bit over $191 million. Then at the end, I just listed some of the bills that have been introduced to the Senate that use that appropriate money out of the Clean Water Fund. And we've had hearings on a couple of these bills, and some of them do not have dollar amounts in them, but I just wanted to get them on the list here to show that there's been some other individual requests for other appropriations from the fund. So that's just a quick summary of what's in the spreadsheet, and as we go through the other dedicated funding areas like Outdoor Heritage Fund and Parks and Trails Fund, I'll also put out a similar spreadsheet for those funds showing what we spent in the past and what's been proposed or available to spend in the next biennium.
Mr. Mueller, I understand Senator Cohen's instructions correctly. We're here to review the recommendations of the Clean Water Council.
Right.
And basically get them out in the public, and then the subcommittee of finance, if there's to be changes made to these recommendations, would be the place where we'd act on that. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's based, yes, that's what I'm assuming is
that's
how it's going to work right now.
That's your understanding of it, too. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Mueller. So on line 197, where it says you're leaving 5% fund balance, it doesn't reflect that on the line, but that's the difference between the 190 and the 185. You do have a fund balance every year that you run.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I didn't put all the calculations of how I got to the 190.9 million. That's based on the amount of revenue coming into this fund. If we spend this amount of money, there would be a 5% balance left after the second year of the within this fund. So there's a little bit more than we've been carrying over about that much of a fund balance already, so this is pretty much spending all the revenue that's coming in and a little bit of the carry forward.
Generally, that's what it's been, is about 5%.
Yeah.
Of what you keep in the bank.
Okay, who wants to go first?
I guess I do.
Okay, say your name for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mike McKay. I am the chair of the Clean Water Fund. I am from the Red Wing area with a group called Lake Pep and Legacy Alliance, and hold one of the two environmental chairs on the Clean Water Fund. With me today is my assistant from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, Barb Peichel, and I'll let Barb talk about the handouts.
So again, for the record, my name is Barb Peichel. I'm coordinator for the Clean Water Council. And you have three handouts in your packets. One is just the presentation that you're going to see today. One is our biennial report that is for the legislature, you, and the governor. And again, if you want to see the council's budget recommendations, they start on page 17. Or if you're a pie chart kind of person, turn to the last page on 22, and you can kind of look at that while Mike's speaking today. What we've also provided today is a side-by-side of the Clean Water Council recommendations compared with the governor's recommendations. So again, the main categories are summarized in about the first nine rows of that spreadsheet. So if you're a spreadsheet person or a pie chart, it's up to you how you want to look at that today.
Thanks, Barb. The Clean Water Council was established in 2006 to provide advice on the administration and implementation of the Clean Water Legacy Act and to foster coordination and cooperation between the public and the private entities doing so. We have a diverse group of people that and organizations with major roles in achieving clean water. And it consists of 28 members overall. 19 are voting members and are appointed by the governor, and 9 are non-voting members. Today, in the room that we have on the council, we have Senator Osmick and Senator Scalzi, and also with the Department of Agriculture, Matt Wallman is here. So they're on the council. We are required by Minnesota statute to submit to you a report by December 1 on every even year, and recommending the Clean Water Council fund activities for the next biennium. It's all to restore clean water to Minnesota. Our FY14-15 is for $191.5 million, which is based on January 2013 Minnesota management and budget revenue projection at that time. So our budget process of the Clean Water develops budget priority percentages, and that's after meeting with all the agencies and receiving stakeholder and public feedback. It's important to note that about 90% of the budget recommendations are similar to the Clean Water Council, of the Clean Water Council and the governor. This reflects numerous meetings and communications that the Clean Water Council and the state agency have made. So in our recommendations, we have recommended steady funding for the monitoring and assessment section, about $22.6 million, or 12% of the total, and the water restoration and protection strategy of $22.5 million, or 12% of the total. The Clean Water Council has recommended increased funding in the groundwater and drinking water. You should note that by statute, the Clean Water has to dedicate 5% of the monies to the groundwater and drinking water category. But this year we're at $23 million, or 12% of the budget. Non-point source implementation
Mr.
funding.
Mr. McKay, I'm being told that the 5% is actually constitutional. It's not by statute. It's actually constitutional.
The non-point and point source implementation funding, our largest, is $111 million, or 58% of the total. Applied research and tool development, 11.6, or 6% of the total. Some of the highlights of the funding priorities is improved. One of the things that we kept in front of us through the whole 2 years is to improve the targeted implementation. We're moving more from a resource or data gathering and monitoring to actually implementing some of the projects, and that's why you see the implementation funding as high as it is. We wanted to provide for local capacity. We have a $2.5 million designated for local capacity grants, and an increase in on-the-ground implementation activities. Priorities for on-the-ground programs were funded where funding will achieve maximum improvements in the clean water. And also notice each dollar invested leverages another $1.45 from local, federal, or private sources. One of the other priorities for the clean water in developing the budget was to improve communications on the accountability and the outcome. We kept wanting to be able to say that we have some measurable outcomes here. So, and maintain water restoration and protection process. Some notes as the examples of the differences between the clean water and the governor's recommendation. One example is the Lake Superior beach monitoring. Federal funding went away, so Clean Water Council's position was that this was a substitute instead of a supplant issue. Another sensitivity of the Clean Water Council. The Minnesota Ag Water Qualification Certification Program, Clean Water Council did earmark $1 million, but we felt that was sufficient for a pilot program for a new program, and that there was other funds available. The Stormwater Best Management Practice Performance Evaluation, through the stakeholder and public comment process, this is one that $1.4 million was added because of what we heard from the stakeholder groups. And the Surface Water and Drinking Protection Restoration Grants from Bowser, $40 million total because of our priority of underground implementation. So I guess with that, I'll close. We have we have the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency following us. So.
Any questions? Mr. McKay? Okay. Is Lewis Smith here? Does he want to say anything?
I'm afraid we ran out the clock on Lewis, and he had a previous engagement.
All right. How about Assistant Commissioner Rebecca Flood.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rebecca Flood. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I'm also the chair of our interagency Clean Water Fund coordination team. On behalf of the Clean Water Funded state agencies and the Metropolitan Council, I thank you for the opportunity to present to you this afternoon. I'd like to provide you with some background on the Clean Water Legacy Act and the constitutional amendment briefly in order to put the governor's recommendations and those of the Clean Water Council in proper context, since many of the members here are new on this committee and don't have that background. So I'll start with a quick review of the federal and state clean water legislation that affects our programs here in Minnesota, describe how the clean water funded state agencies are working together to be efficient and effective in the delivery of our clean water programs, and then we'll highlight selected items within those major funding categories for proposed clean water funded activities during FY 14 and 15, as well as some of our environmental outcomes. So starting off with the foundational basis of our clean water work in Minnesota is the Federal Clean Water Act of 1972. The goal of the Clean Water Act is to restore and maintain the chemical and physical and biological integrity of the nation's waters. And this includes a goal of making all waters fishable and swimmable by 1983. This is obviously an ambitious goal and one that we're continuing to work toward. In addition, the Act establishes a framework to protect and restore water quality. The Act requires states to set water quality standards to protect uses of our waters for things such as aquatic life, recreation, and drinking water. We're also required under the Act to test and assess waters and identify those waters that are impaired or don't meet water quality standards. We have to develop those documents called Total Maximum Daily Loads, or TMDLs, which are restoration plans for waters that don't meet standards, and then implement protection and control strategies to achieve designated uses, which for the past 40 years has been primarily focused on controlling point sources of pollution, those discharges from wastewater treatment plants or factories. In 2002, then, the legislative auditor identified the fact that the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency was underfunded and not able to meet the Clean Water Act requirements of identifying, evaluating, and restoring our waters of the state. As a result, in May of 2003, the legislature directed the Pollution Control Agency to engage stakeholders to address the problem. The PCA charged a diverse group to develop an efficient and effective, accountable path to clean water. And this group became known as the G16, including 16 different organizations that represented business, agriculture, environmental advocacy groups, local units of government, and state agencies. The G16 made funding recommendations and options in February of 2004, and then in July, they reconvened to develop legislation to fund clean water programs in Minnesota. They evaluated more than 100 different types of revenue-creating ideas. For those of you who may recall, the G16 recommended a proposal that affectionately became known as the flush tax, because revenue would be raised by an assessment on sewer connections from homes and businesses. Although the G16 estimated a need of over $270 million per year, they thought it was possible to raise $75 to $100 million per year through a tax increase over 25 years. This estimated need of $270 million per year did not include protection activities or drinking and groundwater protection. At about the same time, in 2004, two cities, Annandale and Maple Lake, decided to replace their aging wastewater, overloaded wastewater treatment plants and replace them with a single wastewater plant. However, a lawsuit was filed and it went to the Minnesota Court of Appeals that reversed the PCA's decision to issue the permit for the new wastewater treatment plant, citing federal regulation that prohibits a new or expanded discharge to an impaired water until a TMDL or restoration plan is complete. The effect of this was that it tied up six new proposed facilities and approximately 30 plant expansions around the state. As you may recall, the economy was strong at that time, and this had a very chilling effect that was placed on economic development. This created a new urgency then for stakeholders and politicians to address impaired waters and funding, and led to the support for the Clean Water Legacy Act. Some of this history may have been forgotten through the economic downturn of the past 4 or 5 years, but these principles still apply. And as the economy gets stronger, this has the potential to once again limit growth if we don't continue to make progress in completing TMDLs. So this all led to the passage of the Clean Water Legacy Act in 2006, Minnesota Statute 114D. The conditions of the act include requirements for the MPCA to identify impaired waters within 10 years, develop TMDLs, 10% of those per year, implement restoration activities, promptly delist those waters when they're considered to be meeting water quality standards, comply with Clean Water Act requirements, also protect unimpaired waters, and deliver funding through existing programs. The 2006 Clean Water Legacy Act focuses efforts to monitor and assess conditions of our waters and on restoring impaired waters, those that do not meet water quality standards, and provided one-time funding to kickstart that effort. The law also created the Clean Water Council, as Mr. McKay mentioned. This law obviously is still in force and effect. In 2008, then, the citizens of our state passed a constitutional amendment called the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment. In addition to setting up the Clean Water Fund, it also set up the Outdoor Heritage Fund. The Clean Water Fund was incorporated into the Clean Water Legacy Act and the amendment, clearly establishing the clean water responsibilities of the Legacy Act to include restoring impaired waters, protection and enhancement of our waters to meet water quality standards, as well as dedicating at least 5% of the sales tax receipts from the Clean Water Fund to drinking water protection. And one other important point to make here is that these funds must be used to supplement our work, not substitute traditional sources of funding, and I'll highlight that more in just a couple of slides. With the passage of the amendment then in 2008, the state agencies and the Metropolitan Council set up an interagency coordination team, and it's the objective of this team to ensure the efficient and effective delivery of our clean water funded programs and to coordinate agency clean water funded activities to make sure that we can achieve our clean water fund outcomes. And this is just an organizational chart highlighting the interagency team and the sub-team structure that we have underneath that. The purpose is to ensure that we're working together across our various programs so that we can efficiently and effectively work together to deliver our programs and services. So, for example, our monitoring and assessment sub-team get together routinely. They make sure that if the Pollution Control Agency is going out to a site to do monitoring, that the DNR is not going out to the same site and collecting slightly different samples for slightly different purposes. So we really want to make sure that we're working together to deliver cost-effective services. Our interagency funded teams consist of the Pollution Control Agency and six partner agencies, the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Health, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, the Public Facilities Authority, and the Metropolitan Council. The partners have developed a coordinated, efficient approach to protecting and restoring the state's waters, and funds have been allocated among these agencies to support many different types of activities. As you can see from this chart, the governor's budget recommendations address water quality monitoring and assessment. Out of a total of $185 million, that is what the governor's recommendations was built off the November forecast, looking at $185 million. 12% of that, or almost $23 million, go for monitoring and assessment. $22.5 million goes to watershed protection and restoration strategies and plans. water quality protection and restoration activities. The classic boots on the ground is actually $115 million, or 62% of the total clean water funded dollars. Drinking water, groundwater protection, 13% at $24.7 million, and applied research and tools at $6 million. Required by the Clean Water Act, monitoring and assessment examines the current conditions of the state's waters and determines whether they meet established water quality standards. The state's watershed approach systematically assesses the condition of lakes and streams. And as you can see from this pie chart, this is one of the PCA's primary responsibilities. This is the list of monitoring and assessment activities we're seeking funding for. One that I will highlight is our statewide monitoring and assessment approach. We conduct statewide monitoring and assessment of lakes, rivers, and streams on a 10-year cycle to determine if the waters are impaired as required by the Clean Water Legacy Act. This includes biological, chemical, and stream flow, habitat, and mercury assessments of lakes and streams. Prior to the passage of the amendment, the Pollution Control Agency had always been conducting a small level of monitoring by comparison, funded from the general fund. This level of funding would have taken us 100 years or more to get around the state and monitor all the water bodies in the state. With clean water funds, it accelerates our efforts, kind of puts them on steroids, supplementing our efforts and not substituting sources of funding. So we still maintain the same amount of funding from the general fund for our monitoring and assessment activities, but the clean water funds supplement and dramatically accelerate our monitoring and assessment efforts. This map illustrates the 81 major watershed approach and schedule to doing intensive monitoring of each watershed. Once we conduct the initial monitoring, the next time we cycle through the state, we're able to gather information to see how effective our on-the-ground protection and restoration activities actually are. The next major category is watershed restoration and protection strategy development. And based on our watershed monitoring and assessment results, a watershed strategy is developed. This includes a federally required TMDL study to calculate needed pollutant reductions for restoration and of impaired waters, as well as protection strategies for those waters that are not listed as impaired that do meet water quality standards. The result of this overall framework detailing watershed restoration and protection strategies. Through this process, we are working with our partners, local resource professionals, and stakeholders to ensure integration of watershed restoration and protection strategies with local water plans and watershed plans.
Commissioner, can you go back to the map one? Just the this one.
The map? Yes, sir.
Yeah. This is, the writing's too small. What are all these colors?
Well, what you see here, the different colors are, we actually began our monitoring and assessment work. We had a couple of pilots that were funded through the Clean Water Legacy Act, and then those you'll see represented in the darker red colors. So we've actually started and completed monitoring in the the intensive watershed monitoring in the watersheds that are denoted in red. And as you kind of progress down through the colors that are in the key on the right-hand side of the map, you can see that we have a 10-year schedule going from 2008 through 2017. So all of these different 81 major watersheds will be undergoing intensive watershed monitoring on every 10-year basis. In addition to that, we also have annual pollutant load monitoring that we do. But this is the very intensive monitoring work that is funded through the Clean Water Fund.
Okay.
One element to highlight in the development of watershed restoration and protection strategies is that they contain tools to help us identify the top 5% of pollutant contributions where there are water impairments. So that, and what's really great about these new tools, again, developed through clean water funding, is that we can effectively target areas that contribute the most pollution to our waters and therefore can then target the clean water funds specifically to those on-the-ground activities that will achieve the greatest pollutant reductions. These models and tools, which include things such as LIDAR, were developed directly as a result of clean water funds. And then when it comes to implementation activities, the actual on-the-ground activities, they're designed to protect and restore watersheds, and that it's at the heart of the state's overall strategy for clean water. This includes programs and projects directed at preventing runoff, improving municipal wastewater and stormwater treatment, and helping small communities invest in new infrastructure. And as you can see, the lion's share of the money goes to both the Board of Water and Soil Resources and the Public Facilities Authority. These are the types of activities and programs that we are requesting funding for. One that I'd like to highlight here is Bowser's non-point source grants. Note that more than two-thirds of the implementation dollars in this category are requested to go to the Board of Water and Soil Resources that they then subsequently pass through to local units of government for non-point source implementation projects on private lands. And then there is an $11 million requested for applied research and tools, which includes research on stormwater best management practices and enhancing our data management systems. The item I'd like to highlight here is in this category of applied research and tools is the County Geologic Atlas funds that go to the Department of Natural Resources. These atlases are critical to the state and local partners in understanding how we can best protect and sustain our groundwater supplies. The final category is groundwater and drinking water protection. Ensuring enough clean, safe drinking water for all Minnesotans requires safeguarding water supplies from source to tap. This category includes monitoring and assessment of groundwater aquifers, contaminant testing, planning activities, and implementation actions that protect drinking water supplies. And on this slide, you'll see that these are the types of activities that we're requesting funding for in this major category. One that I'd like to highlight is the groundwater supply work being conducted by both the Department of Natural Resources and the Metropolitan Council. As an example, given all the attention that White Bear Lake has gotten over the last several years, the work of the DNR and the Council to better understand groundwater supply is very important to ensuring the long-term sustainability of this precious resource. Measuring outcomes of the Clean Water Fund investments is happening at a number of different scales. The Interagency Measures and Outcomes Subteam released a Clean Water Fund performance report, which highlights the state's progress on 18 selected measures for surface water, groundwater, and financial investments. The 18 measures included in the report are a subset of about 50 measures identified by that subteam as being important to track over the life of the constitutional amendment funding. In addition, each individual agency program has a number of measures to track their outcomes. And a second report on outcomes will be available early next year. And you can read all about the outcomes for individual programs online at Minnesota's Legacy on the LCC website. Watch our progress. In closing, then, on behalf of the partner agencies, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to make this brief presentation to you this afternoon. As you know, we're in the process of completing the second biennium of the 25-year constitutional amendment, and we're making good progress toward our long-term goal of protecting and restoring Minnesota's waters, but there's still a lot to be done. The Clean Water Fund has made an incredible difference in helping us to protect, enhance, and restore water quality. Our coordinated approach helps ensure that complementary actions support broader strategies, that the appropriate agencies work toward their strengths, that we're adequately identifying problems and then taking the necessary steps to fix them, and that we're properly targeting both federal and state funding where it can do the greatest good. Minnesota citizens passed the amendment in part because we value our state's water resources, and the agencies represented here today, and they are in the room today if you have further questions, to ensure that those resources are managed to protect Minnesota's environment and economic well-being. And as such, that concludes my brief presentation, and we'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Does anybody have any questions? Does anybody from one of the other agencies have a burning desire to come up to the table and tell us what you think of this? No. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. We shouldn't let her get off without a question,
without
should
a question,
we?
No.
Thank you very much for the presentation, Commissioner. Just overall, the big rivers, how are they faring right now compared to 10 years ago, 15 years ago? Are they getting better?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I would say yes, they are. And I don't know if you're aware that we did, for example, conduct a large study of the Minnesota River here just recently because of drought conditions within the state. We went out and actually repeated a study that had been done both 10 and 20 years ago. And based on some of the implementation work that had been done, primarily focused on wastewater treatment plants providing additional phosphorus removal, which really plays a huge role in suppressing dissolved oxygen, primarily in the lower river under low flow conditions, we've seen a marked improvement, and that additional scientific study demonstrated that because of those actions, dissolved oxygen concentrations in the lower river were actually protected during those low flow conditions. So a lot of work and actions have been taken over the course of years that I think are demonstrating that, if nothing else, we're holding our own on some of these very large rivers and actually making improvements.
And thank you. And the reason I asked that is I did a tour with Senator Dietzick, actually was on a boat tour of the downtown river, which to me was my first experience, and it was just amazing to me how this industry has, you know, had grown on the river here in the big cities, and how we're even able to come close to keeping our rivers somewhat viable with the amount of pollution that must have been going into the river over the years, and how much a better job we're doing now. Just the bridges alone, the mere bridges alone, when you go underneath them, and not having that drainage hole that's draining from the road surface material that falls off of burrs, and we're kind of familiar with burrs after this winter, that's for sure, in our car, whatever you call them, but just that kind of stuff staying out and doing a better job of designing those bridges has certainly got to have helped over the years. So, thank you.
You mentioned drought. Are we, after all this April here, are we having drought problems still, or Commissioner?
I might ask my counterpart at DNR to address that, but I think my short answer would be, while we will have flooding, particularly along the Red River, the north, the soil has been frozen so deep down and is not yet completely thawed out that the water that is melting is not necessarily infiltrating and recharging our groundwater at this particular point. So there is a chance that we will still face drought conditions if we don't get timely spring rains.
Okay. Anybody else? Senator Hoffman, you are here for some reason.
Thank you for the opportunity to address you. Thank you.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. I appreciate your time and your presentation. Steve Morris, are you part of this?
He absolutely is, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
You're for the. Members, Senator Hoffman has a bill that he wants to explain to us that we won't be acting on, but it is a delete everything. So, be relating to wraps, I guess. So, Senator Hoffman, go ahead and tell us what this does.
Greeting, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you. I've presented this in front of Senator, dang it, where has it gone? Senator Marty's committee, and then Senator Sparks' committee, and now I'm pleased to bring the Clean Water Accountability Act before you and this committee, and requesting that this important legislation be recommended to get placed into the legacy bill. But right in front of you is an A7 amendment. That's a delete all And if I could have somebody move that, I would like that because it puts the bill in the shape that reflects recent discussions and decisions.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
We're moving things here? I'm not sure we're moving things here.
Okay.
I think this has to go to the subcommittee, right?
Yes.
Okay, so action would be on actually happen in the subcommittee when we get together with the subcommittee in finance. But you go ahead and explain it to us as long as that's what we're doing today. Is
absolutely, and it involves, Mr. Chair, thank you. In 2008, of course, the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment won by a big majority. And this clean water is valuable to everybody in our state. And that's really the intended goal of my bill was to look at one outcome, which was everybody can agree on clean water. And so there are many stakeholders who came together that forged these needed amendments to the 2008 Legacy Act, and for months and for several years on some folks' meetings and discussions. And that's everybody, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, Farmers Union, Farm Bureau, and the environmental community, as well as the League of Minnesota Cities, all have had discussions within this bill. Many have representatives in the room today, so if there's any questions, we can easily pull folks up. But we're going to continue to walk this this down the road because it actually puts some accountability into what we all can agree on is clean water. It's designed to keep the faith of the voters who approved the amendment in 2008, Mr. Chair, and it will go a long way to ensure that Minnesota's water quality in the future. There's no new regulation in it. There's very little fiscal impact. And while it streamlines how we identify, study, and clean up point and non-point sources of water pollution, we're moving away from the basing studies in accordance with political boundaries to prioritize studies by watershed districts. So it's comprehensive. And my bill will help move from a federal EPA-driven process to the Minnesota-driven RAP process that you saw just before. We can be proud of the individuals, agencies, and organizations that have come together to form a more comprehensive approach to protecting and restoring water by utilizing those RAPs. And thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And with me is Steve Morris, who is a former senator and current executive director of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership.
Which title do you prefer?
Mr. Chairman, in this...
Senator Bach tells me you never lose the title of senator. So
technically correct, but I think Mr. Morris is just fine.
Mr. Morris. The senator. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. As Senator Hoffman indicated, I'm Steve Morris, Executive Director of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. The partnership is a coalition of more than 75 environmental conservation groups with more than 400,000 individuals in our combined membership. And each year we select a small package of initiatives that we champion together as really important to us across our coalition. And this is one of three major initiatives that we're working on this year, which is the Clean Water Legacy Accountability Act. And Senator Hoffman did a very good job of overviewing the why and why we're here. It's about cleaning up the waters as effectively as we can and protecting those who that need to be protected as best we can. It's really about getting the most bang for the buck for the legacy dollars. That was a great overview that the PCA just did on the water cleanup process. So we have the process that's in place where we do monitoring and assessment, then we do these cleanup plans. And what this is about is really building out the Clean Water Legacy Act from 2006 to give us greater specificity and accountability in those cleanup plans so that we have action plans that more specifically say what needs to be done so we can kind of pull apart the different pieces and act on them and do timelines as well as clear action plans. It's kind of if you're going on a trip. So far on some of these TMDLs, sometimes they tell us where we need to go, but it's not real clear how far we have to go, so we don't know if we need to take a bike or walk or take a plane or drive or how we should get there and how fast we should travel in order to reach our goal. So this is really about putting those mileposts in place to make that happen. Senator Hoffman covered very well how it's a Minnesota solution for Minnesota water. And that it is a very modest approach. It's non-regulatory. What it's really about is putting the best available information and science on the table so that as these plans are implemented locally where you're actually doing the water cleanup, we have the best resources and information available. It's been well vetted. We've had many discussions since last fall with the PCA and other parties. But what it does is it is consistent with the direction the PCA is pursuing, but it provides statutory framework so there's clear direction to the agency and clarity to the public. And lastly, just in the general comments, it also responds to criticisms that from a number of sectors, including from some of the water advocates such as us, but also from sportsmen's groups and others, that are we really going to get what we want out of this water cleanup effort? And it's really trying to put this all into a big context so that when we do a TMDL plan, we say where we have to get, what we have to do to get there, and be very clear with people. Mr. Chairman, the amendment is actually pretty simple, so it puts in place these watershed restoration and protection strategies as a definition, as the agency already talked about, and then it lays out the various components that need to be in there, the actual pollutants or concerns that we have, what has to be done to clean them up, what are the actual locations where they have to be cleaned up, monitoring data, and implementation reporting. I'd be happy to go through it line by line, but I suspect you maybe would not like to see it all line by line, but we could certainly do that. I would call your attention to, that's in Section 2. Section 3 is the a non-point priority funding plan, so Bowser would develop a priority list of funding actions for non-point cleanup, which is the runoff.
Before you go any further, what is watershed no larger than a hydraulic unit, code 8?
That, Mr. Chairman, was the map you looked at earlier. It's that you asked about how the monitoring was going. That's basically the way the agency is breaking down the cleanup strategy. So it's by these HUC 8 watershed units. So it's currently the way they're doing it.
So everything that's listed here, they're not doing right now?
Mr. Chairman and members, no, I would not say that they're not doing it. They're moving in this direction. But what it does is it makes it clearer in law that the direction they're going is good, and it adds some clarity in the backside to make sure they actually do it and that it is retained so that the public will have a clear understanding of what needs to be done in each of these cleanup plans.
Thank you, Brett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I echo that very same question. Thanks for the answer. My question is the agency on board with this, Senator, and I'm sorry, I was diverted from the
PCA.
The immediate beginning testimony, Senator, and my question would be, does this redirect the Constitution? I'm just constantly worried about us redirecting away from the Constitution, and that's one question. And is the agency okay with this? And is it going to cost the agency some dollars here? And I don't know if we have appropriations for this.
Mr. Chair, Senator Engelbretson, you know that those are questions that came up both Bowser, PCA. Matter of fact, our pollution control agency folks are over there. I was like looking the other side of the room. The fiscal note is being redone to reflect today's amendment, and we're estimating that about $67,000 annually will be needed by Bowser as the amount is verified. It's got to be verified in the fiscal note because we made a small change today that would do that. And I think you know, those folks from Bowser can, if they want to verify that now or later on, that's fine. But the conversations have existed for a long time. And, you know, even when it got before Senator Sparks' committee, you know, the League of Minnesota's.
It wasn't before Senator Sparks' committee, but it was the Senator Margie's.
I thought we heard it in yours as well. Different bill. It was just the one. Sorry.
See, the memory thing's going for you this
week. You know, it's so true, Mr. Chair. You know,
having a rough day.
I tell you, it's getting hot in here. Is anybody hot?
It's a bad week.
Getting no respect.
I'm glad somebody else is having that problem.
Of course, you know, maybe Senator Sparks has a bad memory, and yours is good. You never know here, because
actually, Mr. Chair, it was in front of it was in front of Ag.
I think you're right.
It was because that's where the conversation came up on the Farm Bureau and Farmers Union.
No, we have the computer says you're wrong. It's right.
Okay, maybe it was there twice. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, any further comments? Do any of the agencies need to comment on this bill?
It was in the House.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Morris, are you still need to say more? go ahead. I mean,
well, if I could, in response to Senator Ingebrigtsen's question.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
This is entirely consistent, and this is one of the reasons we're doing it, with the 2008 Legacy Amendment. One of the concerns that we and many sportsmen and other stakeholder groups have had is just we're spending millions of dollars, $8.5 million a year or so on these plans, and the plans that we've seen so far, some of them have some real shortcomings, and they don't have the type of specificity to actually help and enable the locals to make good decisions. And so it's really about getting the right information on the table so we actually can get the results that people expected in 2008 when we voted for this money. So it's not at all diverting it. It's really about more accountability to get us to our goals, and has broad support from not only our coalition but many of our partners in the conservation and hunting community who want to make sure we get to those results.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Adelka with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I just want to quickly answer the question about the agency's position on the bill. First off, we want to thank the author and the sponsorship organizations. The bill and the amendment that you see before you right now has improved greatly, and we are. It is definitely something that we are moving forward to, the RAPs, the Watershed Restoration Protection Strategies. We are still, Bowser and PCA still have some small tweaks that we're working with them on. However, this is in a very good position compared to where it was. In terms of cost, it is correct. We are still working on a fiscal note that we hope to have finalized fairly shortly. Again, the changes made by the author and the sponsorship organizations have dramatically reduced the fiscal note on it to match what the agency is working on and what is in the governor's recommendation for the Clean Water Fund and the work specifically needed for these RAPs. Real quick then, to highlight on the question dealing with, is the agency doing this or should be doing this work already? As was mentioned earlier in the presentation, the Clean Water Legacy Act that was set out and also the Federal Clean Water Act really steers towards the development of TMDLs and what needs to be done. And TMDLs will be a portion of what is in the RAP, but as mentioned by the author and the supporting organizations, is that we really do need to have more information available to everyone as we go about implementing the dollars from the Clean Water Fund to reach our goals of clean water. And so that's what this does. It really is a TMDLs 2.0, where it goes beyond with just meeting what's required in the federal law, going beyond that, looking at multiple stressors, biological, chemical, and others to get a full picture of the waters to really better target the resources that we have to restore and protect our waters.
Any other questions, anybody?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sparks.
Just a quick one. And I don't know. I know this is coming kind of quick. Did the Clean Water Council have a chance to discuss any of these things, or is this something you're kind of doing above and beyond that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sparks, the folks that were involved in this process were the Kirk Adelka, the folks from Bowser. There's been multiple meetings. The council itself, they were not part of the meetings that I was in when we were having this discussion. League of Minnesota Cities was part of that. Farm Bureau, Farmers Union. Am I missing anybody?
I think you're covering it well.
Okay. Yeah.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. That was going to be my exact question, and with the chairman of the Clean Water Council here, Mr. McKay, I'm wondering if you had weighed in on this at all, if you want to make any comments. I mean, it's a work in progress. I get that.
Have you seen it?
Thank you. I think at this point, I would answer that this has not been in front of the Clean Water Council, and I think for many, that'd be the first time they've seen it. That said, I don't think that I would want to speak for what the Clean Water Council position would be on this without some kind of review and understanding of what the bill is.
But Senator Hoffman, this doesn't really require the Clean Water Council to do anything, does it?
Correct, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it does not.
Okay.
It's PCA. I mean, it's really, if you look, Mr. Chair, it's...
And then is there any implications here? I've been really concerned about, we have some really stringent laws in the state of Minnesota that are requiring our small towns and communities to do a real lot of cleanup, and that costs a real lot of money. And is there anything in here that has an indication that it might be adding to those costs, or is this
You know, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no, I don't think so. There was a deep discussion on the rod, do you go 50 feet or 100 feet, rod 16 feet for, you know, riparian buffer stuff, you know. The answer to that is no, this is going to have relatively low fiscal impact on, as noted. But if I miss it on that, that was my, yeah.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could, we have had a number of discussions with League of Minnesota Cities, and we made some language adjustments to take care of their issues and concerns that they had with it. So okay. It's really targeted to bring a parallel information that we have for cities and a point to more of the non-point arena, so we have more specificity to direct and inform local cleanup.
Is there anybody else here that would like to comment on this amendment that's in front of the committee today? Okay. Members, any questions that are in the rest of?
Mr. Chair, just a point of clarity. Just if these dollars are going to be expended out of the clean water portion of the MPCA's budget, I'm not totally familiar with how the Clean Water Council operates because I'm not a member of that, but I guess it would seem practical that it be brought to them, or at least talked to them and discussed it with them somehow during the process here. And if that's going to be coming out of their budget, I'm assuming it is, out of the clean water legacy portion of the MPCA budget. Maybe Mr. Kudelka could answer that, and then we'll just...
It's true.
Oh, sorry. Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record again, Kirk Kudelka with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. If you use the spreadsheet that the Senate fiscal staff has put together, if you look at line number 117, TMDL development, this is the funding area which was mentioned in our presentation too, that dealt with those watershed restoration and protection strategies. As we presented our budget to the Clean Water Council, this is the area that would be used for. We've had some preliminary, we had some presentations with the council on where we're looking to go as this has been under development. However, this language is not the specific language that's been requested by the agency, by others. So while they may not have seen the language, they are familiar with the concept that the PCA has been looking at, because we have shared that information when we've worked together to create a budget. And then also on our presentation of the RAPs and what that means, what that next generation of TMDLs, TMDLs 2.0, will look like.
So are you comfortable that this is to a point where you can work with it, and that Senator Hoffman is comfortable with where he's gotten it to? And I mean, there's peace in the valley on this thing, or is there still work to be done?
You know, absolutely, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Kurt was in yesterday, you know, bringing something forward, just as well as, and it, the night before we went in front of Senator Marty's committee, the folks at League of Minnesota Cities, and we were making changes that were, you know, collaborative and reflective of where we need to be. Again, the intended outcome is everybody can live with clean water in Minnesota, and this gets us to that next step, plus gives some accountability in place for the PCA to, you know, look at the TMDL. So that's my opinion of it, and Kirk, and they'll keep moving and tweaking forward.
And are we comfortable that we're not duplicating here?
Mr. Chair and committee members, we worked very closely with the author and the sponsoring organizations to make sure that we aren't doing anything redundant in the efforts. And that they've made a lot of changes, and we appreciate that. There are still some, as mentioned, small tweaks by the Board of Water and Soil Resources and MPCA that we're working on, but we're comfortable with the direction the bill is moving.
Okay. Any further comments or questions? Okay. Seeing none, then, before we adjourn tomorrow, we have a couple more bills tomorrow. And we'll be meeting after session again. So whatever time session gets done, unless what's in session tomorrow? So we have the game and fish bill tomorrow, and then the lands bill. And it shouldn't take too long, I don't think. So after session, we'll come here 15 minutes after session, so you all know that now, so I don't have to announce it tomorrow. Okay? All right. So meeting adjourned.
Or after we